mending fences in Riyadh today, Friday, March 28th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama went to Saudi Arabia to repair a strained relationship with the kingdom. This former U.S. ambassador from the Bush years weighs in on what it will take.
Well, the first thing is personal diplomacy. I haven't really seen the same kind of personal connection between President Obama and King Abdullah.
And later, you'll never believe what the Italian government's selling on eBay right now.
40 BMWs, 30 Alfa Romeos, there's 9 Maseratis, and several Jaguars.
Start your engines. Plus, the Danish twins who embody sibling rivalry.
When they were little kids, they used to compete to see who could empty the dishwasher more quickly.
Now they're battling for the taste buds of craft beer drinkers around the world.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It was a big deal to sit down today between President Obama and King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. U.S. relations with the kingdom have been strained for the past few years. Washington and Riyadh have clashed over several issues, from the response of the Arab Spring pro-democracy movements to Washington's limited support of the rebels in Syria. Today's visit by Obama was brief, but intended to reassure America's key ally in the region. Robert Jordan was the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 2001 to 2003. He says that Syria is one of the key issues on the table, but certainly not the only one.
The Saudis have for many years been concerned about our failure to help resolve the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And more recently, they have been very concerned about the Obama administration's abandonment, as they see it, of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, the embracing of the Muslim Brotherhood, and then more recently, the advances with Iran in an attempt to solve the nuclear issue. And so Syria is certainly in the middle of all that, but there are many, many other issues, I think, that the Saudis are very concerned about as they view this administration's posture in the Middle East.
Yeah, there sure are a lot of knots in that ball of twine. I mean, you were ambassador to Saudi Arabia during a period of time after 9/11 when the U.S.-Saudi relationship actually grew stronger. Is it clear to you what the U.S. needs to do to fix this current rift with Saudi Arabia?
Well, the first thing is personal diplomacy. And one of the things that I observed during my time as ambassador was the way in which President Bush bonded with then Crown Prince, now King Abdullah, and in the way in which they continued to stay personally in touch with each other. But I haven't really seen the same kind of personal connection between President Obama and King Abdullah. And it has been complicated, I think, by the way in which President Obama embraced the Muslim Brotherhood, which the Saudis view as really an existential threat to the kingdom.
Yeah, I mean, the current crackdown in Egypt and 500 people sentenced to death recently, that's not exactly what the U.S. had in mind either.
No, and this is actually something that I think the Saudis need to be concerned about as well. If the generals can't govern any better than the Brotherhood did, then the legitimacy of the Saudi support for the generals is brought into question. I suspect President Obama is going to raise that significantly with King Abdullah.
We're kind of going with the assumption that it is necessary to repair this rift, but is it, in your opinion? I mean, maybe the U.S.-Saudi relationship has just gone past the sell-by date.
No, I think actually when you look at it, many more things hold us together than divide us. We both have a significant interest in countering Islamic extremism in the Middle East and the threats to the United States that spring from that. I think we also have an enormous common interest in Iran not securing a nuclear weapon. I think we have enormous common interest in providing a stable market for oil and petroleum products in the world. And I think we have a significant common interest in supporting a moderate Muslim approach to the world, which I think the Saudis are increasingly understanding is an important part of that relationship.
You've been in the room during meetings between Saudi leaders and a U.S. delegation. How freely do people speak? How tough can the Saudis actually get with Obama?
They can get pretty tough. The group meetings will be pretty polite, and then there will be side meetings with various contingents of the delegation in which people will speak more frankly. One of the things about a summit meeting between two heads of state is that a lot of the work is done ahead of time by the staff. And so quite often when you get together, it is to ratify or restate the issues that have already been agreed to. Typically, when you finish one of these meetings, you have a joint statement. And so I think it's going to be very important to see if we actually have a joint statement from the Americans and the Saudis on what this meeting really has ended up confirming.
Robert Jordan, the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 2001 to 2003, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Christopher Dickey wonders if President Obama raised the issue of comic books with King Abdullah. The foreign editor of the Daily Beast has written about the news that a top religious authority in Saudi Arabia has issued a fatwa condemning a comic book series called The 99. What's surprising and infuriating to Dickey is that the comic series has Muslim superheroes who are positive role models. First of all, Christopher, what is the evidence that an actual fatwa has been issued?
Oh, I have a copy of it. It was issued by the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia and several of his co-counselors. So it's really no joke. It's not just some loony cleric in Saudi Arabia saying Mickey Mouse is satanic, which we've seen before. No, this is quite serious and I think quite dangerous.
And what does this fatwa say? That the comic book series should be banned from Saudi Arabia or something worse?
It says it in clerical language that people should shun this series, both on television, because there is a television series broadcast in Saudi Arabia, and the comic books themselves.
The optics of it are very much kind of like Marvel Comics, but in Arabic. I mean, tell us about this Kuwaiti psychologist, Naif al-Mutawa, who created the series in the first place. What prompted him to do it?
Well, what prompted him to do it was 9/11. Naif, whom I've known for many years, was really shocked by what happened, as many in the Arab world were. But he was particularly because he had spent a lot of his life in the United States. He was educated in the United States. As a little boy, he went to summer camps in the United States. And he felt a strong identity with American values and with the American people. And then 9/11 horrified him. But what horrified him even more was that he realized that his own children, as they looked at their surroundings in Kuwait, in the Arab world, had almost nobody that they could look up to the way that American kids looked up to Superman or Batman or the characters in Marvel Comics. So he thought, let's try and do something about that. Let's create superheroes who are Muslims and identify with Muslim values. And the way we can do that is their names can identify with the attributes of Allah. So there are 99 attributes or 99 names of Allah, which include words like light and wisdom and strength, all very positive virtues. And while they didn't have those names in the sense that Allah has those names, they had those names in the sense that lots of people in the Muslim world do. And lots of people are named Nur, light, or they're named Jabbar, strength. He mixed it all together, and he had it approved by Saudi Arabia in every way, shape, and form. His company is funded through an Islamic bank. He got all the paperwork done in Saudi Arabia, and he's been in Saudi Arabia for several years with the comic books and with the television show. And then all of a sudden, this fatwa is issued. And there are a lot of questions about why that is.
Now, I'm curious to know, since the 99 has been in Saudi Arabia, what kind of conversation did it create?
Well, you know, there's always been a steady stream of negative criticism that said this is in some way trivializing the Quran, it's trivializing the faith. And yet, Naif has always responded, and I think very clearly, not only was that not his intent, but that's not what he's doing. They've been very, very careful. The idea was not, heaven knows, to offend Muslims. It was to give Muslim children, particularly young boys, characters that they could really look up to and dream about and idolize. And the argument of the critics is they should be just reading the Quran and dreaming about that and idolizing the characters and that. But of course, that's a whole different framework than the way most modern children fantasize, including modern children in the Arab world.
Christopher, you spoke with Naif al-Mutawa. What's his response to the news about the fatwa?
Well, you know, he's very, very frustrated by it. I think he's a little threatened because along with the fatwa, there's been a Twitter campaign against him, accusing him of all kinds of things. You know, in the end, he probably will win out because the Saudi clerics every so often go way overboard and King Abdullah and the Saudi royal family have to pull them back. Certainly, it's the kind of thing that Obama should have brought up because Obama in 2010 made a big point of pointing out Naif and pointing out the 99 and saying that was just the kind of outreach that he thought was so great in the Arab and Muslim world.
Christopher Dickey, foreign editor for The Daily Beast, thanks a lot as always.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Italy is now about a month into the leadership of a new prime minister. Matteo Renzi has vowed to clean up the government in a country where instability and corruption have long been the norm. And in one of his challenges to the political status quo in Italy, Renzi is selling off some of the government's fancy official cars. Yesterday, about 150 of them went up for auction on eBay. And these cars are sweet. Naomi O'Leary is a Reuters journalist based in Rome who's been following the bids. What kind of cars exactly are we talking about here, Naomi?
So we've got about 40 BMWs, about 30 Alfa Romeos, and among them, there's 9 Maseratis. So these are among the most expensive brand of cars in the world, and several Jaguars as well. So we're not talking about your average Fiat Punto, as it were.
Yeah, really. I mean, this is some serious automotive bling. Who was using them before? Ministers or even lower ranking figures?
They all come from 3 ministries, the Ministry for Justice, Defense, and the Ministry of the Interior. So the reason the new prime minister is doing this is because there's been a lot of public pressure and demand for cuts to the kind of privileges that politicians enjoy. There's a perception that the political class is an elite which hasn't suffered in Italy's economic downturn in the same way that ordinary people have.
All right. So they're upset about it now because there's an economic downturn. But I mean, what was the reaction when the Italian government first went on this buying spree, loading up on Jaguars, Maseratis and Beamers for civil servants on the taxpayers' back?
It's an interesting point you raise because some of the cars that are for sale, according to Italian media, are actually already well known to the press. They say they're the same Maseratis that were somewhat notoriously purchased in 2011 in October, which was at the height of the Eurozone crisis, just before the government of Silvio Berlusconi collapsed.
Wow, so they bought him in the middle of the crisis.
It was a controversial decision and caused a minor scandal.
Are they attracting any attention yet from bidders?
Absolutely. The stars of the show, the Jaguars and the Maseratis, they haven't gone up on eBay yet. But so far, the BMWs and Alfa Romeos are proving quite popular. And the Alfa Romeos seem to be, at the moment, set to sell for roughly between 8,000 and 9,000 euro, which isn't that much. But, you know, these are cars with a lot of miles on the clock.
Right.
And the BMWs are more like 15,000 euro.
So does the government really expect to get a lot of cash for these cars? You say they've got a lot of miles on them. They're not going to be bringing in the original showroom value. Or is this just a symbolic gesture?
More than anything, it's a symbolic gesture. It will save more than they'll raise from selling them. They'll save in running costs because these aren't just cars. They also had drivers. In total, Italy's public administration, according to its own 2013 estimate, spent over 1 billion euros in 2012 just on cars, on the running costs, official cars.
So what would happen if civil servants were told, no more cars, you're going to have to take mass transit?
Well, it's difficult to say. There's definitely a lot of public demand for that. Part of the reason why a new movement, which is very anti-establishment, called the Five Star Movement, got so much success a year ago was great public anger at what was seen as the elite class, the politicians and their privileges. And their election rallying cry was to kick them all out of power and take back the government for the ordinary people. So there's definitely a lot of public demand for this.
Naomi O'Leary with Reuters in Rome. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Still ahead on The World, we'll introduce you to Denmark's Cain and Abel of craft beers on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. 9 months. That's how long Secretary of State John Kerry gave Israelis and Palestinians to come to some agreement on future peace talks. Not peace itself, just an agreement to talk about it. There's only 1 month left before that window closes, and so far, no real signs of progress. The end goal, one of them at least, is to negotiate an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and the creation of an independent Palestinian state there. So, in the meantime, what's been happening on the ground in the West Bank? Daniel Estrin reports now on one incident that didn't make much news when it happened, but offers a telling glimpse of how messy life can be there.
A few weeks ago, in an olive grove outside the village of Luban, someone tried to steal a mule. Now, that might sound way too trivial to even bother mentioning on the radio, but in the West Bank, something like this quickly becomes a very high-stakes game. Ghassan Daglas is a Palestinian official whose job it is to monitor Israeli settler activity in the West Bank. He says he got a call around 11 in the morning. There are Israeli settlements on nearly every hilltop surrounding Luban. And a farmer there had caught a settler trying to steal his mule.
The settler was in a car driving. He saw a mule tied up to a tree and thought he would steal it. I guess he figured he'd get on the mule and ride it there.
There, as in back to his settlement up the road. But the farmer caught the settler, put him in a car, and telephoned the village council to come quick. Soon, a whole group of villagers were surrounding the farmer's car with the settler kept inside. When Douglas got there, he called Palestinian liaison officials, who called their Israeli army counterparts, who arrived on the scene. One of the villagers started filming with his cell phone as the farmer told the soldiers what had happened. The trespassing settler was named Zohar. He was only about 20 years old.
I told him, "Zohar, I want to put you in my car. You are like my son. Do not be afraid."
The Israeli soldiers escorted the settler out unscathed. End of story. The same thing also happened a few months ago in a nearby village. A group of settlers in their late teens and 20s were seen attacking Palestinian farmers in broad daylight. Palestinian villagers caught them and beat them up. But despite a gathering mob, the group held the kids on the roof of a house, gave them bandages and water, and made sure no one laid a finger on them. Palestinian officials called Israeli soldiers, who escorted the settlers away. The residents of Luban have every reason to be angry with Israeli settlers. In 2010, Jews were suspected of torching a village mosque and olive trees. In 2012, a soldier and two Israeli women were arrested for spraying "Mohammed is a pig" on a village home. But capturing someone in the act was rare. So nabbing the mule thief was like the occupied trapping the occupier, the mouse catching the cat. And it shows a strategy that Palestinian officials like Douglas are trying to enforce.
If there's a problem, we announce it from the mosque so the whole village knows about it. This way everyone can gather and make sure the situation is contained and no one gets hurt. And then we immediately need to call people like me, a Palestinian coordination officer. But we need to create a better system for coordination.
That is, coordinating with Israeli soldiers to get the settlers out, to avoid Palestinians harming those settlers. For the Palestinians, this is a strategic move, Douglas says. Whenever Palestinians have harmed or killed settlers, he says, revenge attacks occur and new settlement outposts are built.
Most of our people are aware of the repercussions and punishments that would fall on our heads if they were to use violence.
Settler attacks can happen weekly, says Sarit Michaeli of the Israeli rights group B'Tselem. She says these spontaneous vigilante responses, neighborhood watch style, are the only real way Palestinians can protect themselves from settler attacks because the Israeli security forces aren't doing their job.
Each and every incident seems minor. One car here, one olive grove there. But if you view the series of attacks that have been perpetrated against Palestinians in specific areas, every single incident contributes to a very, very large picture in which people are living in places where they have no protection.
The West Bank settler organization condemns these attacks, but settler leader Dani Dayan also chastises the Israeli security forces for failing to prevent and prosecute settler attacks. He says he's met with the attorney general, the police inspector general, the head of the Shin Bet clandestine security service, the army officer in charge of the area.
And I begged, I would say I demanded from them to be more harsh and first and foremost to be more effective. I don't have an intelligent answer to the question, why and how our law enforcement agencies are so unsuccessful.
The Israeli police says last year it formed a unit to thwart this phenomenon, and Dayan says it did help somewhat last year. But over the past 8 years, UN figures show the annual rate of Israeli settler attacks has almost quadrupled, which sometimes leaves Palestinians feeling that their only recourse is taking law enforcement into their own hands. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, Luban in the West Bank.
Today is the day.
No. What did he say?
He's going to destroy the world.
Yes, the epic film Noah, starring Russell Crowe, hits screens worldwide today.
A great flood is coming. We build a vessel to survive the storm. We build an ark.
Noah's wife is played by Jennifer Connelly, and at the New York premiere this week, Connelly had this to say about the movie's appeal.
I think different parts of the movie will resonate with different audiences depending on their backgrounds. I think it's really a movie for everyone.
Well, maybe not everyone. There's actually a disclaimer at the beginning of Noah saying that the film does not represent the biblical account of Noah. That hasn't caused much of a controversy yet, but the movie has sparked an outcry among Muslim groups around the world. About half a dozen Muslim countries have banned the film. This media critic in Egypt says most Egyptians would like to see the movie, but religious authorities banned it because Islam prohibits the depiction of biblical prophets. One place where you can see the movie is Lebanon. It was approved this week by the country's censorship bureau with reservations. Reservations not just on behalf of Lebanon's Muslims. About a third of Lebanon's population is Christian, and some Christian groups there are upset as well, claiming the movie portrays Noah as a dark, unsympathetic character. Brian Godawa, author of a book called Noah Primeval, says a 2-hour and 17-minute epic based on about 40 lines of biblical verse means you've got to take some poetic license.
There's always an extreme audience that expects you to have every single detail the way they interpret it, or they're not going to like it. To me, what was more important is, what are all those details pointing to? What's the worldview of the movie? What's the message? What's the meaning of the story?
The movie is expected to be a big hit, taking in as much as $38 million this weekend. Maybe they'll need a bigger boat. Coming up, Ana Tijoux and her soundtrack for protests in Chile. First, though, we've got news headlines here on The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, 50 years ago, white farm owners in Delano, California, cursed labor organizer Cesar Chavez. Now the mayor, a Latina, credits Chavez for changing people's lives there.
It's like the caterpillar that became the butterfly. I think that's what happened to our lives.
Plus, a sibling rivalry spills over into craft beers.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-mile run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. If you thought the showdown with Russia was maybe winding down, proof to the contrary today. President Obama bluntly called on Russia to pull its troops back from the border with Ukraine. They're supposedly there as part of a routine exercise, but U.S. intelligence has reportedly concluded that those Russian forces are ready to invade eastern Ukraine at any time, if ordered. Also today, Ukraine's ousted president resurfaced. Viktor Yanukovych called for all Ukrainian regions to hold a referendum on their own future. That's what Crimea did before Russia quickly annexed the region. None of that will sound reassuring to Ukraine's interim leaders in Kyiv. BuzzFeed reporter Max Seddon is there. He says uncertainty reigns in the Ukrainian capital.
It's really impossible to know what's happening at the moment. The Kyiv government has made a series of statements over the last few weeks where they have said that Russia could invade at any moment. And with the latest U.S. intelligence assessment, which says that as many as 50,000 Russian troops could be hiding along the border and ready to pounce, it's something that we feel could happen at any time, but no one really has a good grip on how or why. And the question, if something does happen, is the Kiev government ready to react to that. They and their partners in the West were caught very much flat-footed by the Russian invasion of Crimea. The defense minister resigned this week after a lot of protests over the way that the Ukrainian government handled that. A lot of commanders that I spoke to on the ground when I was in Crimea over this month were upset that they weren't getting any direct orders from Kiev. They and the Ukrainian military feel that the Kiev government really abandoned them and didn't want to give them specific orders because they were too scared of taking responsibility in case something went wrong. And the issue is whether now that they've had some time to regroup, they can correct those mistakes and be prepared for anything that Russia might do in the East.
Is it a question of being prepared kind of in terms of personnel and materiel, or just being kind of ready for anything? I mean, are they ready?
It really depends what you're talking about. If you're talking about Russia sending in the tanks and the helicopters and the planes, Ukraine has no way of stopping that. The Russian military is about eight times the size of Ukraine's. The Ukrainian military is so underfunded that people have been taking 50-cent donations over a phone hotline to try and fund it. Yulia Tymoshenko, the former prime minister who got out of jail during the revolution after her arch rival who jailed her, President Viktor Yanukovych, fled, she announced that she was running for president in elections for May yesterday, and she said that she wasn't going to spend any money on ads because that money would be better spent on funding the army. The thing that they have been putting a lot of efforts towards stopping are these things called Russian diversion groups. The Ukrainian secret services say that Russia is sending these small groups of citizens over the border where they don't need a visa. It's pretty porous. It's right. All the major cities are right there on the border: Kharkiv, Donetsk, Lugansk. And they are starting trouble. They are posing as pro-Russian protesters or going underground, starting fights, and trying to get violence involved.
It's crazy, though. You're basically saying the Ukrainian government is running a public radio fundraising drive to fund the army.
Well, they don't have any money. The IMF agreed yesterday to give them this loan program of $14 to $18 billion, which requires that they put in these significant austerity measures to fix huge structural problems in the economy. The economy has been on the brink of default for months, and they need $30 billion at least over the next 2 years just not to default on their debt. This is one of the reasons why you had a revolution in the first place. It's not just because people were unhappy with the government. It's when every side of the political class has failed so demonstrably and proved in the eyes of the people to be so corrupt, and unemployment is so high, and the standard of living is so low. This is one of the poorest countries in the Western world. That is what made people angry enough to go and protest so determinedly in the first place. Mm.
Max, you're about to leave Kiev on a reporting trip to Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine. What do you think you're going to find there?
I'm not anticipating seeing any little green men with no insignia who totally are not Russian soldiers like in Crimea, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
One thing that has been prominent in the east, especially in Kharkiv, is that out of this city, Kharkiv, was where a lot of the paid thugs who were being sent into Kiev to disrupt the protests against Yanukovych were coming from, these ultimate fighting clubs. So there have been protests. They have spilled over into some violence, but I'm not expecting it to turn into fully-fledged riots. That said, I'm definitely going to be shying from making any predictions about what's going to happen in Ukraine. If there's one thing that I've learned from the last few months of this crisis, is the minute you start making predictions is when the opposite starts coming true. And really anything could happen. The only person who really has his finger completely on the pulse of how things are going to play out over the next days, weeks, months is Vladimir Putin. And it's really up to him to make the next move.
Max Sedin with BuzzFeed speaking with us from Kiev. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yesterday, we took you to rural California for a historical tour of Delano. That's the town where civil rights activist Cesar Chavez began a massive farm workers' protest movement back in the 1960s.
Farm workers in Delano, California, have begun an unprecedented strike in the Central Valley. Filipino and Mexican workers have joined forces to demand fair wages and better working conditions for their members. Would you say
that— Today, a new movie opens that looks back at the life of Cesar Chavez and his movement. But how has Delano changed since the Chavez era? Sasha Coco, station KQED, has that story.
The farm town of Delano is still surrounded by vineyards, but the power dynamics here have shifted dramatically. Back in the 60s, white growers controlled the police, the courts, and the town government. Today, if you visit Delano City Hall, you'll meet people like Grace Vallejo.
Right now, we're in front of the pictures of our city council. As you can see, they're all Hispanic. So we've come a long way, a long, long way.
Vallejo's family is Mexican-American, and she picked grapes alongside her parents for years. Now she's the town's mayor and the first Latina to hold the job.
I, for one, do credit a lot of it to the work that we did with Caesar, because he trained on how to be organized, how to get resources so that we could move forward on whatever we're going to do in our life.
Vallejo showed me something else in Delano that took a while to get off the ground, a high school named after Cesar Chavez.
We're approaching the Cesar Chavez Titan Band. And hey, kids! How about playing a little tune?
The school was built on a former vineyard about 10 years ago. But when it was under construction, there was still tremendous animosity towards Chavez in Delano. Growers were seething from the economic impact of the grape boycott, and the farmer who sold the school district the land for the high school tacked on an additional fee for naming the school after Chavez. The debate over the school's name divided the town, but school officials sympathetic to Chavez eventually won. They argued the school's name recognized how Chavez gave farm workers the confidence to get educated and become power brokers in Delano.
It's a huge change in Delano. It's like the caterpillar that became the butterfly. I think that's what happened to our lives. You know, we don't want to fly away. We want to be here, and we want to improve things.
Okay, I want you all to clear off your desks to prepare for the test.
Many of the students and teachers at Cesar Chavez High are children of farm workers. English teacher Lorraine Lanis came back to Delano after earning a master's degree. She says she didn't learn about the significance of her town's history until she was in college in San Diego.
Delano, the farm worker movement, Cesar Chavez, were being mentioned in textbooks all over the world. I knew very little history, so I made it a point to learn my history.
Now she teaches her students that history and the importance of the farm work that still sustains Delano.
Something that I tell my students all the time are grapes that are being eaten in New York. If they're ever bought at a Costco in New York or at a Walmart or even Disneyland, those are grapes that are picked by our relatives here in Delano, and they're being sold internationally.
But new immigrants coming to Delano, many of them don't know who Chavez was, says Irene Mendoza. She's one of thousands of Delano residents from Mexico who still works picking and packing grapes.
¿Saben? Porque escuchan de otros campesinos.
She says, I hear from other farm workers that thanks to Chavez, we have this or that, but they don't really know who he was. Mendoza knows Chavez's movement brought her the unemployment pay she gets in the winter when work in the fields dries up. Like many other immigrants here, Mendoza came to the U.S. well after the farm worker movement peaked in the 60s and 70s. Since then, the union that Chavez co-founded has seen its membership dwindle. Mendoza's never worked under a union contract and says she's not sure she needs one.
Ahorita las condiciones del campesino están bien.
Now the conditions in the fields are better, says Mendoza. We have cold water, enough bathrooms. The only thing missing, she says, is that she barely earns above minimum wage. The Farm Workers Union is hoping field workers like Mendoza will be more inspired to join the union when they see Chavez on the big screen. About 1,000 farm workers watched a premiere of the new movie this week, projected in front of the old Union Hall in Delano. For The World, I'm Sasha Coca, Delano, California.
Cain and Abel, Venus and Serena, sibling rivalry, it's an age-old story. If you're a beer connoisseur, you may actually have imbibed the product of a sibling rivalry. Mikkel Borg Bierso and Jeppe Jarnet Bierso are identical twins from Denmark who've both become famous for their creative brews. And they can't stand each other, which might explain why one's in Copenhagen, the other's in Brooklyn. Jonah Weiner's story about them is in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine.
I'm not a super over-the-top beer geek, but if you dip a toe into the world of craft beer, you'll hear about these two breweries that these two Danish twins run. One is called Miggler, and one is called Evil Twin. They make really kind of fascinatingly extreme beers in addition to sort of more drinkable beers. They'll put all sorts of crazy ingredients into their beers. They
have like distinct approaches. Just how far out do they go?
Both these breweries are gypsy brewers or phantom brewers, which is a term that basically means that they don't have a fixed brewery. They can brew all over the world. And one thing that that means, especially in the case of Miggler, is this kind of radical freedom to just produce. So he made 127 beers last year. So when you ask me to describe, you know, a typical one, there almost is no such thing. But for instance, he has a beer that incorporates avocado leaves, 5 different kinds of chili peppers, black beans, I think.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. They're more like beer chefs and tastemakers than they are, it seems, brewers, which is interesting that they both kind of went down this track. But why do they hate each other?
They have differing perspectives on their relationship, unsurprisingly. Mikkel, who's kind of the more reserved, taciturn of the two, it was very hard for him to talk about it. Mikkel sort of describes it as being kind of just a fact of being twins. You sort of look in a mirror, you see something that you don't like about yourself in this other person, just this very intense kind of conjoined, you know, psychology and relationship. It seems sort of the foundational thing is this incredibly competitive relationship they've had since they were little. They used to compete to see who could empty the dishwasher more quickly when they were little kids. They both became middle distance runners. They were, you know, separated from each other by 1/100th of a second at the biggest race they ever ran.
Right. Yet they're the youngest by minutes of the two brothers, claims the rivalry actually began in utero.
Yes, that's right. If it weren't for a C-section, he says he would have been first. But in fact, Mikkel cut the line. So, yeah, you could trace it that far back.
How did they both get interested in beer? Did one get interested first?
So, you know, there's this kind of huge craft beer explosion that happens in the States in the 80s and early 90s, and it sort of ripples out to Copenhagen. Both brothers catch wind, but Jeppe starts this beer club where he and his friends are going to track down the rarest, craziest beers they can find and talk about them. Mikkel joins that club. From there, they both sort of try their hands at home brewing in their kitchens, and Mikkel kind of sticks to the brewing and forms Mikkeler with a friend of his who was also in the beer club, whereas Jeppe opens up a bottle shop, which becomes very well known, and they stock Mikkeler and sort of give Mikkeler, you know, an early boost. They kind of vouch for Mikkeler by putting them on their shelves.
The rivalry between the two brothers, I'm sure, ain't been great for family harmony, but has it raised the bar for beer quality?
You know, I don't want to be glib about it because there are very real emotions between these two guys.
And no, it's clear in your article.
Deep well of emotions between them. That said, one thing that they both talked about was that having someone that they always wanted to compete with did sort of make them be better. It's Jeppe in the story who says, I always had someone I wanted to beat. You know, it's not like they're only fixated on each other, but certainly knowing, you know, that there's this other guy who, you know, who they feel so intensely toward, who's doing the same thing, does no doubt spur on their own creativity.
So let me put you on the spot, Jonah. Having tasted beer from both brothers, what was your favorite?
I can dodge that simply by saying that if both these guys in 2013 made upwards of 200 beers, I tasted only a fraction of them. I'll pick two from each, if that's not too much of a dodge.
Yeah, go for it.
There's a yuzu beer that Evil Twin makes called Femme Fatale Yuzu, which just incorporates that Japanese fruit in just this really refreshing, crisp, inventive way. And Mikkeler makes a series of beers that are produced by what's called spontaneous fermentation. It's this old Belgian tradition of throwing open the windows of the brewery while you're brewing, allowing for wild yeasts that are just floating around in the air to do what they will with your beer. So Mikkel does a series of spontaneous beers where he'll, at the end, infuse unlikely things like beetroot, rose hips, and more sort of traditional things like, you know, sour cherries. So any of those that you can find are definitely worth checking out.
Well, thank you so much for the steer. Journalist Jonah Weiner, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, his fascinating article about the Danish twin brothers Mikkel and Jeppe and their craft brewing rivalry will be out in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Jonah, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Marco.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The World Cup is now less than 3 months away, and Brazil is hustling to get everything ready for soccer's premier global tournament. But some stadiums are not ready yet, including the one in Sao Paulo, where the opening match is scheduled for June 12th. And street protests against the tournament are almost a daily occurrence. There was one last night in Sao Paulo, and Fabiano Leal was there. He's with the Ground Truth Project, a reporting initiative of the news site Global Post in partnership with us here at The World. Fabiano, first of all, just set the scene for us with some of the recordings you gathered during these demonstrations.
Marco, what we saw on the streets last night was mostly young Brazilians, 20-year-olds, chanting, "Não vai ter Copa." That's the motto for the protests that we have seen taking place, saying that there will be no World Cup. And some of them really truly believe that there is a chance that the World Cup will not happen. They will tell you that they are not satisfied with how much the country is spending with the World Cup, whereas they do not see good conditions and good resources in terms of public transportation, public health, and education. So as we marched along, about 1,000 protesters that were followed by police officers as well. That's what we heard. We heard the protesters send messages to the president saying, "Isn't it a joke that there is money for the stadiums but not necessarily for education?"
Now, some of the protesters, I understand, are sometimes referred to as neither nors in Brazil, as in neither in school nor in a job. When you talk with them, how do they describe their situation?
It's not only, we don't see only the generation neither nor on the streets. We also see an educated group. They're just not satisfied, as they say, with what they have right now. They are not satisfied with their education. One thing that you hear very commonly is that they don't feel their generation is necessarily represented in politics. They are not necessarily expecting anything from the current political structure, they say.
There are also rumors I've heard that some of these protests have been infiltrated with youth who don't all share the same focus as some of these students. Does everybody have the same mission out there?
The interesting thing about this protest is that they are organized by various social movements coming together. And you also have other people that will explain to you that they are not necessarily out there to stop the World Cup, but that they are out there to demand different basic needs. There is really a sense of unity when you're out there in the crowd. You see these different groups coming together and marching together, chanting related to different causes, but they're united.
I mean, it's hard to imagine protesters actually halting the World Cup at this point, but it is a major international event. It costs billions to put on. I'm just wondering, are these protesters basically criticizing the whole set of priorities in Brazil? Because soccer is like religion there.
We do hear that a lot. We do hear that soccer is like religion. And some of these protesters themselves, they say that they are not protesting against soccer, that they love soccer. On the other hand, they really don't think that the government is necessarily setting its priorities straight.
Fabiano, yourself, I gather you've got Brazilian roots. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, I was born in Brazil and I lived here until I was 16.
What's it like for you seeing this anger and frustration? Do you get it? Do you understand it?
When you're on the streets, you really see the anger, you really see the frustration, and most importantly, you do get a sense of these people speaking up against what in Brazil we have seen for years, issues of inequality that don't necessarily get addressed.
So how's this all going to shake out? Will these protesters still be out there on June 12th when the opening match between Croatia and Brazil happens in Sao Paulo?
That's the big question, and we're less than 3 months away from the World Cup. And when you talk to these protesters, some of them are really, you know, saying they are asking for tourists not to come. They're saying they will be on the streets, and what you hear is that the fight will not take place in the stadiums, it will really take place on the streets. That's what they are telling us.
Fabiano Leal is a fellow with the Ground Truth Project, a reporting initiative of the news site Global Post, and we're partnering with them over the next 6 months to hear from the project's young reporters about the stories they're covering. And Fabiano, thank you for telling us about this one.
All right, thank you so much, Marco.
We stay on the protest beat in Latin America, ending the show with some altiplano music today. Hang on, did I just go all ethnomusicology on you? All right, let's try this. Here's some really cool music from Chile that I can't stop listening to at the crib from Ana Tiju.
puedo ser tu gran amiga, incluso tu compañera de vida. Yo puedo ser tu gran aliada, la que aconseja y la que apaña. Yo puedo ser cualquiera de todas, depende de cómo tú me apodas.
So back to that word altiplano, Spanish for high plains, and it refers to the Andes Highlands in South America. Well, you can hear the Andean vibe on that track, Antipatriarca. That makes Ana Tijoux, I guess, a sort of new high plains drifter. She shuttles between rap and the altiplano on her new album, Vengo. Before, she'd been almost always focused on rap. But while she was writing songs for Vengo, she found herself taking guitar lessons with a friend who brought along a charango, a small version of the lute from the Andes.
And he began to play charango, and I don't know, I became super over-emotional, like, wow. You can explain, you listen those instruments and something that come from I don't know where begin to touch you in a certain way that you can't even explain it. So that's when I understand, like, I got to put charango, quenas, and all these organic wood instruments in this album.
Vengo en busca de respuestas con el manojo lleno y las venas abiertas. Vengo como un libro abierto, ansiosa de aprender la historia no contada de nuestros ancestros, con el viento que dejaron los abuelos y que vive en cada pensamiento de esta amada tierra, tierra. Quien sabe cuidarlo es quien de verdad la quiera. Vengo.
Vengo, the title of Tijoux's new CD, is inherently political. Vengo means I come, and on the title track she wheels out verses like this. I come to build a dream, the brightness of life that inhabits the new man. I come looking for an ideal of a world without class that can rise up. There's been a lot of rising up in Chile since 2011, student protests primarily. Ana Tijoux has provided some of the soundtrack for those protests, which she says are far from over.
I think it will be a year of a lot of movement, and from the student, from the high school, not university, but much, much more. The most radical are the high school kids. They are more clear about everything, about the power. Because there are all these people saying beautiful stuff, but they are all friends. They all live together in the same neighborhood. All those kids go to the same school.
Something tells me her songs about class struggle will continue to frame that debate in Chile. Ana Tijoux was speaking there with our contributor Beto Arcos in Los Angeles. So we leave you today with more fist-pumping sounds from Tijoux's new CD, Vengo.
Y abrimos así nuestros brazos tan encadilados y nos acurrucamos al origen de los tiempos, a la fuente del universo donde yace el sentimiento de vivir este comienzo. Vengo con la sangre roja, con los pulmones llenos de rimas en mi boca, con los ojos rasgados, con la tierra en las manos. Venimos con el mundo y venimos con su canto. Vengo a construir un sueño, el brillo de la vida que habita en el hombre nuevo. Vengo buscando un ideal.
The World's Theme Music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Annenberg Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at Carnegie.org, the Ford Foundation, the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.